By 1812, Imperial France, under the leadership of Napoleon, had become the dominant force in Europe. Only Britain and Portugal were still fighting against an empire that now stretched from the shores of the Atlantic and the Mediterranean to modern Russia. It was at this point that a young United States decided to declare war on Britain. For the next 2 years, the countries would fight battles on land and sea to try and establish supremacy over North America. It was a war that would end in a stalemate and reconciliation, but which, if things had gone differently, could have changed the fate of Europe and the US forever. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. In this episode, we're going to look at the largely forgotten War of 1812. Sometimes called the Second Revolutionary War, we are going to explore why it's more than just a footnote to history. I am your host, Gareth Edwards, aka John Bull, and with me today is Angry Staff Officer, a good friend of mine. We have debated many years, so Staffer, would you like to say hello?
Hello, and good morning from this particular part of the world. That was, of course, being contested by your insidious Sons of Albion, I guess I have to call you.
I mean, this is one of the reasons I wanted you on here. So for those unfamiliar with Staffer, Staffer is an American Army officer and a historian, and he specializes in US military history with a particular focus on war and memory. And when we decided to do this episode, you were, of course, the first person in my book I wanted to talk about this. We've talked about it online before in various guises. And it is a fascinating war, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the ones that I like to say that Americans tend to chalk it up as a W in the win column and just call it good, but it's far more complex than that. It's one of when I used to teach this conflict, I would start out by just sort of posing the general strategic goals for the United States during the war, and then talk about the U.S. loses tactically nearly every single time, and yet somehow emerges having achieved strategic goals. And my students were just sort of staring at me like, how? No, that's not how this works. And I'm like, yeah, it's War of 1812. There are no rules. It's just vibes.
It is arguably kind of a very vibes-based war, isn't it? I mean, well, we'll get into, I think, some of the how it's fought and why that is. It's probably useful if I kind of set the general scene, and then I'll let you maybe set the kind of the geographic scene almost, because both are relevant here. So as I said in the intro, we're in a position where in 1812, France is really at the height of their power under Napoleon, and they're dominating Europe in a way that, frankly, Europe won't see again until the rise of the Nazis in World War II. And so Britain is really on the back foot. It's active in Portugal. The Portuguese are still in the war. But it's Wellington, or the man who will become the Duke of Wellington there, Arthur Wellesley, is already on the back foot in Portugal at this time. He's hiding behind the lines of Torres Vedras. He's under threat from three of Napoleon's marshals. So the war is not looking good on the continent for Britain. But it's worth noting, I think, for people that since about 1806, from about 6 years now, both France and Britain had been blockading trade with the US, because the US was such an important source of material and everything. So that had sort of set the scene. From the American perspective, Staffer, what's the key things people need to know going into this?
One, political. The United States had, post-revolution, we had, and post-constitution, ratified in 1787. We get George Washington as our first president under the Constitution. We have this sort of great era of, yay, everything's golden, wonderful. We love George Washington. Politics are fine until the election of 1800, when everything just goes to utter crap. Highly contested between a very, how should we call it, aggressive and vituperative and backbiting and dirty dealing two-party system. So nothing that anyone is familiar with today.
And this is the Republicans and the Federalists, isn't it?
This is the Republicans and the Federalists who begin war with each other almost literally, but you end up with Jefferson winning. Now, what's happening in 1800? Well, you've got a whole bunch of things happening. One, that whole problem in France. And so when you talk about this trade blockade of the United States, well, we begin it with an own goal. Jefferson blockades our own ports against France. Now, why would we need to blockade our own ports? Well, because the country is very divided politically, socially, and economically. One whole section of the country is incredibly tied to trade with Britain and France, and especially British colonies in Canada. And that part of the country is New England. And they're all Federalists. And so when I talk about why the political scene is so important and so fraught, is that you have the scene set already for a heavily divided democracy that is still trying to figure out what the hell it does. I mean, for example, the vice president is the person who loses, is the loser of the presidential election. So your like number two, if you're president, is the person that you were like a minute ago throwing character assassinations at. So it works out great. But so you've got a heavily divided political base that is already everything is about economics. And as the war in Europe continues, and you have expressions of more American neutrality, we're neutral on this, we're neutral on that. With the other thing we're not neutral on, even though we're calling ourselves neutral, is trade. There will be a slogan that carries through the war, and one could almost call it really a slogan for U.S. military interventions, almost up to the present day, but free trade and sailors' rights. Is going to be the slogan that drives the United States in the War of 1812. This idea that we're going to trade with anyone we want. And of course, from a mercantile system in Europe, that's not cool. And then from a belligerent perspective for both Britain and France, you know, it is not acceptable that the United States is trading with both of them. So it's so key to consider that that type of economic situation. The other situation I want to just throw in here is this really strange human terrain feature called Canada.
and it's important for people to note that Canada doesn't really exist at this point.
Right.
So if
well,
you're
they might also need to know that Canada does exist in general.
Canada as a geographic zone exists. But very much at this point, what we think of as modern Canada is not yet the polity, the kind of combined citizenry of Canada in the modern sense. It's still a very divided Correct. Place, isn't it, really?
Highly divided. And we have to remember where so many of these people, these Canadians, these proto-Canadians, if you will, come from. They come from disaffected Americans, disaffected the loyalists who opted to leave the United States at the conclusion of the Revolutionary War, between 80 to 100,000. We don't have exact numbers because it's really unknown how many people migrated across. But the Royal Navy, when they evacuated Charleston and New York in 1783, at the conclusion of the Revolution, all these people just flow into Nova Scotia, which at the time was huge, has to be split in two a few years later to create the province of New Brunswick. So literally an entire province is created in Canada of American loyalists. Now, this becomes incredibly important because these are all families who have ties back across the border to New York, to New England, to South Carolina, to all across the colonies. And when we talk about the fighting that will occur around Canada, there were many people who believed, oh gosh, there's so many people who, you know, many Americans believed, oh, there's so many Canadians who are just Americans. Surely they will flock to our side, as if, you know, the persecution of 8 years in the American Revolution just was like a nothing. And this becomes a key point, one point that American historian Alan Taylor will call the Civil War of 1812, because you essentially have so many Americans fighting each other along the frontiers in New York, in Michigan, and along Lake Champlain area, Vermont.
So let's talk as well about some of the naval causes from the British perspective, jumping back a bit again, and what the British are doing that aggravates a lot of this situation. I mean, we've already talked about this trade blockade that exists and it's in force. There's also the issue of impressment. And impressment, for those who are unfamiliar with it, is it takes a lot of people to run a navy, and you need trained people to run a navy. And during the Napoleonic War, Britain's requirement for sailors almost triples. You're looking at the Royal Navy needing approximately 120,000 sailors at all times to blockade France, to oversee global trade, to maintain that supremacy over the seas that is so important. And to meet those numbers, the Royal Navy has to resort to, frankly, quite coercive methods. And that method does include finding sailors who maybe previously served in the Navy and have dodged out of it because it's not necessarily the most fun place to work at this point. And one of the most common dodges for that at the time was, well, sailors are always in demand. So you sign up on a different ship for a different nation or in a different port. And mostly in previous times, you could kind of get away with this. Not when the Royal Navy needs 120,000 people. And so what the Royal Navy starts doing is it starts impressing. And that means it's stopping ships from other navies and from other civilian ships from other nations that are flagged. They're running a flag.
Or even its own nations, don't forget.
Or even its own nations, you're right. and it's looking for people it can take off of them. And this causes a lot of issues with the US, in part because of the idea that, well, we're not in an era of dual citizenship. And as far as Britain is concerned, as far as the Royal Navy is concerned, if you are a British citizen, you are always a British citizen. They don't care if you're now claiming to be an American citizen on an American vessel. If they think that you should be back in the Royal Navy, they're grabbing you and putting you back on a boat. And that causes tremendous issues, doesn't it?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, it is an emotional stab at the entire idea of the American Revolution. This is how the Americans are seeing it. They're seeing it as a repudiation of their war for independence. And you know, it, like I said earlier, this is, you know, Royal Navy is not targeting, you know, not reaching out and going, United States, we are going directly after you. No, they just need people. I mean, they're doing this to their own ships, their own people. Their press gangs are going into towns all across England and snagging anybody up. It's just that in the United States, you know, they're like, hey, we're a citizen of a different country. You can't do this. So this becomes, you know, I think for every conflict, you have to have sort of an emotional, like, you know, that powder keg, that thing that really triggers people. And I would say there's a carrot and a stick in the War of 1812 for the United States. The stick is very much impressment. It is as everyone absolutely up in arms, literally. And of course, the carrot is Canada. This idea of we need to seize this region. It should rightfully be ours. And so, like, in the years and months running up to this, to the conflict, this is it's fueling so many conversations, both inside the halls of Congress and then outside. And the newspapers are, of course, being very responsible with their press and not flagging the flame. No, they're absolutely flagging the flames in one way or the other. So everyone's getting all riled up. Any small thing like, you know, a Royal Navy vessel firing into a somewhat unarmed U.S. Navy vessel, such as the Chesapeake and Leopard affair, famous for all those fans of Aubrey Maturin out there, the Patrick O'Brien books. The horrible old Leopard, but it causes casualties and it creates sort of this international incident and continues to serve in the American mind as yet another example of perfidious Albion. You know, you cannot trust England. They're always going to come back and try to take what's theirs.
And to step in on the less perfidious Albion side for a second, there's also one thing that I think is worth
the kinder
writing.
Albion?
The kinder Albion, you know, because we were always really kind, honest. But there is something that's worth noting as well, is that since about 1807, when both Britain and the US have in theory banned international slave trade, the British have been operating fleets out off the West Africa Squadron and similar places to try and police the trade in slaves across the Atlantic. And actually one thing that started to happen is British ships, often working out of, say, Liverpool or the big kind of triangle trade ports, they need a new flag to fly. They need to fly under a different flag if they're going to carry on slaving. And even though the US has technically banned that trade, it's not really actively policing it itself. So one of the common ruses that is used by slave ships, and a lot of these are called Baltimore Clippers for a reason. They are quite literally built in Baltimore. It is the prime source of these fast clippers that are used for slaves. They will flag to the US. They might not genuinely be a flagged US vessel, but they will have a US flag on board that they can run up so that the Royal Navy can't stop them. And that gets muddied in this waters as well. Like you say, the press on both sides aren't being particularly careful about what they're reporting. So some of those stops might be ships that have human cargo, but that's not the bit that's getting reported. The bit that's getting reported is just that a vessel with a US flag was stopped by the Royal Navy, and vice versa. It's not necessarily reported that it wasn't a real US vessel. So all of this combines, doesn't it, to create a powder keg that kicks off this war in 1812. And one thing I love about it is just this, we forget about communication speed now. Because actually, just before the war kicks off, one of the premises for the war has actually disappeared without the Americans knowing it, hasn't it?
Yeah. You've got all the grievances that Congress brings up. And we did miss one big one. It's sort of an American bogeyman that... if ever you want to frighten Americans in the colonial era through the 19th century, you just mentioned, the fearful savage myth. And you have so many native nations who are reeling from the effects of the Treaty of Paris in 1783 that ends the American Revolution and does not treat them as equal participants. And causes huge cessations of their land that had been under nominal crown control to Americans who immediately get to work trying to partition it up and sell it off to try to pay off all of our massive debts that we incurred in the war. And you've got these Native nations who are trying to figure out how to live literally between the British in Canada and the Americans south and among the Americans, and it's very difficult because the Americans are continuously breaking treaties, and the British are not averse to, maybe sticking a couple brown Bess in there and helping out. So they've got the Tecumseh Confederacy, which is Tecumseh is a Shawnee political proto-religious leader, and You have sort of this idea of a confederation being formed, not new. The Iroquois the Haudenosaunee Confederation, and prior to that, the Pontiac's Confederation. This idea of a group of Native nations banding together to fight off a larger enemy, not new at all. Very dangerous. Usually gives whoever they're fighting a bloody nose at first. And you sort of have this support surrounding Tecumseh growing in the Great Lakes region and further to the west in the United States.
So that takes us nicely, I think, to the Great Lakes and where this happened. So almost to describe how things kick off, you get this very odd set of events that happens, which is on the 11th of May, 1812, Spencer Perceval is assassinated, and he's the British Prime Minister. He remains to this day the only British Prime Minister ever to be assassinated. Fascinating guy. We'll definitely do a podcast on him at some point. Not least his clever use of orders in council to actually ban slavery. But he's assassinated, and that leaves Lord Liverpool becoming new PM. Now, what no one's really realizing at the moment is while this is all happening, the Americans are going through the state of getting to the stage of declaring war. And actually, Lord Liverpool, one of his first actions is to lift the trade embargo that the Americans had wanted lifted. France had already lifted it by this time, and Liverpool lifts it. But news of that doesn't reach the US until after the war has already been declared on the 19th of June. And that leaves everyone on the British side kind of caught out, because for some reason they hadn't really seen this coming.
And understandably so, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. So President Madison is the president of the United States at the time. And he is, as I mentioned, overseeing a very heavily politically divided country. The East Coast really isn't into this war. They're into the business of making money. And boy, brother, when, you know, there's war in Europe, you know, the business of business is good. It's from primarily the western frontier part of the nation. So Tennessee, Kentucky, these newly formed states who really they're looking west. They're looking west, they're looking north, and they're seeing sort of this idea of all this land ripe for the taking, not just from Native Americans, but also from the British. And there's this idea of, hey, if we strike now, we strike hard, we strike fast, we will seize Canada. You can't make war with just your least populated and poorest part of your country as your political support. If you don't have the wealthy and populous New England northeastern states, I mean, that is where the bulk of manpower, Pennsylvania North, comes for the U.S. Army during the previous conflict in the War of Independence and the Seven Years' War. You don't have a snowball's chance in hell of actually getting sort of a good campaign going. And so what happened, you know, the British sort of looking at this are going, what are they doing? Why would they declare war? They're not remotely prepared. And they're right. The Americans immediately, you know, Madison calls up tons of volunteers, calls up militia, establishes, you know, 20 new regular regiments. You know, the American standing army is tiny at this time. You know, these regular regiments are going to take time to, you know, get established, provision, man, equip. We've got like three arsenals. None of them are near the northern frontier. We don't have any type of logistics or sustainment background in place because of this whole idea that a citizen soldier army is the best to defend against invasion. Yes, it is. But when your plan is to invade, that causes considerable issues.
And I think from a British perspective, the building on that, keeping New England happy, is something that the then Governor General in Canada, who's Lieutenant General George Prevost, I think is his name at the time, is he actually has very actively defied the blockade and supported effectively illegal trade down the Canadian coast and into New England. He's not stupid in the run-up to this. He's made sure that the New Englanders are happy people and like actually quite like the British. And actually, he's not got a lot of troops available to him at the start of the war, because obviously Britain's hugely committed on the continent and beyond. He's looking at one regular regiment. He's got some Canadian volunteers and the Fencibles, which are sort of the National Guard if you're in the US, or the Territorials in the UK. The Fencibles are the sort of equivalent at the time. They're semi-professional soldiers, let's maybe call them. And he's also got some artillery, and he's got what are known as the Veterans Regiment, a unit of veterans. What that actually means is they're people who are seen as too ill or have conditions that mean they can't be on regular service anywhere else. So if there is a window for the US to succeed, it's almost like it's at the earliest point. But of course, as you say, they're not really ready for it at that point.
No, the Navy, of course, is the most ready, and you get sort of these staggering series of U.S. victories. They're all single ship actions. There's no fleet actions. We don't really have a fleet to speak of. We got some pretty great frigates.
I mean, I think you've got 13 super frigates from memory is how they're described.
Well, you have the original six, which are your they are sort of the super. You know, they're supposed to be, what are they? They're supposed to be 44 guns. And really, if you add in all the carronades and everything else, you're looking at close to 50 really strong superstructures. The most famous, of course, being the USS Constitution. You also have Congress, President, and a few others. Then a whole handful of brigs and sloops and, all other various craft, which immediately all stream out and begin engaging the Royal Navy, as you mentioned, Royal Navy, undermanned, overstressed, just really going through it. And now you've got these Americans who come out with some pretty well-built ships, decently trained crews, and in a number of single ship actions, give a real bloody nose to the Royal Navy. It's very embarrassing for them, which I take great joy in, as much as I hate to mention anything about the seafaring stuff. it's a completely different story on land. And we should take a look at the geography of, you know, what does it take to invade Canada? What does that mean? Well, for those who aren't familiar, there's a whole bunch of massive lakes in the way, running from the east towards the west. You have Lake Champlain, which is not a great lake. I keep forgetting. I always get it confused as a great lake. Sort of this narrow lake that provides a great avenue of approach from sort of New York, Vermont, up into the heart of Quebec, right towards Montreal. And they're moving further to the west. You have Lake Erie over Ohio. And then further on, you have Lake Ontario, then Lake Erie. So these sort of three large water courses do two things. One, they block the movement of people who have to walk for a living, aka armies. However, if you control them, boy, it makes logistics phenomenal. Because newsflash, roads still suck in 1812. So if you need to move vast amounts of people and things, water remains your best mode of transport.
And this is, I mean, this is the reason why the lakes play such a critical role in the Revolutionary War as well. The Cousins War, if we're going to be nice and British about it. But it's that fact again, that, like you say, they are the hub of this activity, aren't they? We're going to talk probably a bit, or it might come up in conversation, we'll talk about Lower and Upper Canada. And it's probably worth people knowing when we're talking about this, that they're almost reversed from what you might have in your head, aren't they?
Yes, Upper Canada is the bits that are to the south. Well, Lower Canada is to the north, which is, I mean, it's also, if you look at Lake Champlain, for example, the way the water flows, if you go up the lake, it's actually heading south. And so when you start talking about operations in this area, it's a really great way to give everyone a massive headache and I have no idea where you are, which approximates U.S. ground strategy in 1812. Because there's three sort of prongs of the invasion. General Hull in the west is going to advance northwards from Detroit. No, he's not really facing, you know, he doesn't have that many troops, but he's not facing what he thinks is too much of a threat, mostly Native nations. You've got the great old Dutch family, the Van Rensselaers from New York. You've got our Van Rensselaer jumping off from Niagara, mostly a force of a lot of militia. And dag nabbit, if the United States isn't about to find out, pay the piper on what happens when you kick the can down the road on actually establishing solid militia legislation that makes rules about when you are allowed to leave the state, let alone the country. Newsflash, did not, which will give rise to many militiamen saying, I'm not invading Canada. I'm not allowed to leave the state. I read my contract. And then you've got old Henry Dearborn of American Revolution fame. They actually, he was on the first invasion of Canada in 1775. They ate his dog to survive in the northern Maine or northwestern Maine woods as they were starving on their way to Quebec. But he's back in command and he's going to lead a force along Lake Champlain towards Montreal. So three prongs, good stuff. If they all move at the same time, everything in the garden will be lovely. They, of course, do not move at the same time. They're not, really, some of them don't even move at all. Hull in Michigan is senile and immediately botches his entire campaign. He gets defeated by Tecumseh and eventually retreats to Detroit and then loses Detroit.
He's almost blagged out of Detroit by Major General Sir Isaac Brock, who's kind of the military guy in charge from the British side, at least in the early part of the war, who effectively almost pulls a racism on him by doing what you suggested earlier and says, well, look, I'm going to win, but, you know, I can contain my own troops. But, you know, these native guys, God knows what they'll get up to. So he goes full racist. Detroit is almost seized by racism because that contributes to Hull effectively surrendering the fort.
And that is such, it is a ploy that, God, that gets used anytime Europeans are fighting each other in North America with native allies on either side, that gets pulled out. And yes, Brock absolutely fools Hull. Again, don't give your command to a senile guy. What does this mean? Really, you know, all three of these sort of botched failures, you know, you've got really the most significant, you know, Van Rensselaer is going to experience the problem of, yeah, my militia aren't coming with me as the regular army crosses over into Canada. You've got fighting Battle of Queenston Heights in October, which it will see the death of Brock, great painting, and the death, you know, the creation of a real Canadian folk hero, even though, you know, he's British, but this war is so key to creating the Canadian identity and the American identity to a certain aspect, if we look at it from the point of view of ignoring realities and facts and just making up whatever sounds good to us. That's sort of our own identity. But what each of these botched, failed offensives sort of gets to is the understanding on both sides that, God, yeah, just crossing like these narrow spits of land, these tiny little maneuver corridors, we can't fight this way. You can't fight this way. You can't sustain this way. It's hard just moving stuff across rivers. And most of New York is like rivers. And so what you have is sort of this, the beginning of an arms race on the Great Lakes, which is boat building, ship building, as both sides are just racing to see how many sloops of war, how many brigs of war can you build to try to wrench control of the lakes back from your opponent. So in microcosm, it's just becoming the Napoleonic Wars, just fought on lakes.
The word Great Lake is not a misnomer here. If you're listening from and you're in Britain, or if you're in various play parts in Europe, you might be thinking lake as a relatively big thing, but something you can kind of see the other side of. That is absolutely not what we're talking about with the Great Lakes. They're almost like mini inland seas, aren't they?
They are. I mean, so Ontario alone, it's the smallest Great Lake, but it's got, you know, it covers 19,000 kilometers, square kilometers, with a, you know, maximum width of 53 miles across, a significant depth to allow for cruising of warships. These lakes will have storms that rival sort of nor'easters and gales. They are mini little seas and oceans. And, you know, Lake Superior is kind of scary, honestly. You're just like, how is this one? You know, it's the largest of the Great Lakes. How is this a lake? How is this not a inland sea or an ocean? So when we talk about these Great Lakes, many of them are connected via waterways, canals, and rivers. And they serve as the economic heart of these Canadian provinces and these these U.S. states in peacetime. And then, of course, in war, they immediately transform into, well, you know, to paraphrase the great opening of Master and Commander, you know, 1812, lakes are battlefields.
And I think when you describe it as Napoleonic War in microcosm, I think that's a really good description, because we're not talking giant battles here. We're not talking like you're seeing on mainland Europe at the time. There are set pieces, but it is so much of it is on the one hand, the native allies of the British, because the British they'd offered Tecumseh an alliance, a specific alliance before the war broke out and the Confederacy had turned it down, but they did take it up later. You've got almost this kind of guerrilla-esque war going on one part of the field of operation. And then elsewhere, you've got units maneuvering against each other, and as you say, ships and small squadrons maneuvering against each other. But it's not to the same epic scale of the Napoleonic Wars. It is almost to a certain extent like they're being fought in miniature for the next 2 years.
Yeah, it's very small forces. The only success that the U.S. begins to see in 1812, 1813 is in the West, which, if you think about it, it makes sense because that's where your base for support is. You have a lot of people who are very excited to fight a war where they will see the direct result of their victory, which is they get more land. And this is where, you know, these repeated hammer blows of frontier militia and volunteer and regular forces against Tecumseh really, really begin to shatter the Shawnee Confederation going into 1813, which really begins to unhinge that level of support for the British in the West. In the East, it's another sort of multi-pronged attack beginning in April. American troops take York, present day Toronto. There's fires. We'll say that there's fires. Somebody burns it. Probably Americans. There are fires. York burns. Big propaganda event. But these are in Napoleonic terms. Every battle of the War of 1812 would be considered a minor skirmish. I mean, these are just, you know, maybe 2,000 to 3,000 troops moving against each other. Every single American offensive up against, whether it is up through Niagara or against through Champlain, the Hudson River corridor, Hudson to Champlain River corridor against Montreal, are defeated. You have one of the great scoundrels of American military history, James Wilkinson, has entered the chat, a guy who is failure at every military thing except for self-publication. Beginning in the American Revolution, he just gets this reputation for being a go-to guy. He sucks. He's terrible. In the interim, between these wars, as his general-in-chief of the army, is a senior-most army officer, he's in the pay of Spain as a Spanish spy. I mean, this guy's making Benedict Arnold look kind of okay.
We're doing Benedict Arnold in future legendary American hero, Benedict Arnold.
That's a good one. I mean, Benedict Arnold's actually competent. Wilkinson's not. He brings his army up, unites it with another on near Niagara, tries to move north, gets blocked, and gives up in failure. So the real big event in 1813 happens on Lake Erie at the Battle of Put-in Bay. Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry wins a very hard-fought, bloody little naval battle on Lake Erie, breaking the deadlock there, which is going to allow ground movement on either side of the lake, as well as movement, a sustainment across the lake, and really set the stage sort of for 1814 as the war enters its next year. What else is happening in the United States is New England is pretty much out of this thing. And there is going to be a meeting in 1814 called the Hartford Convention, a convention of the New England states to meet together and say, hey, is this thing worth it? Like, is this United States thing worth it? Should we secede? New England being the primary economic driver of United States prosperity at the time. The South will eventually wrest that away once cotton becomes incredibly profitable.
As a gamer, one of my favorite things you can do in, say, Victoria 3 or a game like that is if you end up at war with the US, is just force them to release New England as an independent state. Because for this period of history, you have absolutely just instantly economically crippled the entire US. The moment New England, that sort of Boston-ish area and beyond, is taken out of the equation.
And we tend to forget what just an economic and manpower powerhouse New England and the greater Northeast is in this era. This is where all of your, if you're looking at trying to, I don't know, unite elements of national power to coerce an enemy to your will, well, you kind of need to get New England on board. And New England is so absolutely not on board. And the British, this becomes a key part of the British strategy looking into 1814. But something also happens in 1814, doesn't it? Something.
It's kind of you to bring this up. So in August 1814, actually a couple of days before my birthday, which I like to celebrate both at the same time, we had the Battle of Bladensburg, which kicks in. And of course, that ultimately is a big victory for the British. As there's this wonderful quote you get from an officer, post it on the British side of things, which is describing the Americans there, which is, "Never did men with weapons in their hands make better use of their legs," which, I mean, as a diss on your opponents is pretty good. But of course, the key outcome of that is it opens the path through to Washington. And it leads to probably the thing that, if people have heard of the War of 1812, is the one thing they know about it, which it is that moment where the British burned down the US Capitol and what is effectively the White House.
They do. Fat lot of good it does them, but they do. And I would like to note that there's a great myth out there that Canada burns the White House, which I'm not sure how Canada moves backwards in time to execute this, considering it did not exist. But there were no Canadian troops present. These are British regulars. Also, why are there so many British regulars all of a sudden? But it has something to do with Napoleon being defeated.
And this is the problem that the Americans face, really, isn't it? It's almost a sort of inverse of like World War One. So in World War One, you've got Germany worried about when the US will enter the war and bring its economic might to bear in 1918. In this war, the Americans can do okay as long as Britain is effectively having to fight the entirety of Europe at the same time. Because Britain is the industrial megapower at this point, and the financial megapower. So once Napoleon's, the US kick off this war almost exactly as Napoleon is marching into Russia. So if they could have picked a worse time to start the war that looked good, it is this time. Because as you say, what's happening now is Wellington's Peninsula veterans, his arguably the finest army that Britain has ever fielded, are now freed up. And they're now arriving in force in the US theater. And they are not mucking around.
Can you imagine how ticked off you would be?
Yeah.
Can you imagine how mad you'd be? Like, oh, hey, thanks for fighting through the mountains and all that stuff around Portugal. So you got to go to North America now.
Yeah.
Like, what? No.
Well, and it does genuinely annoy a lot of the officers. Like the officers go over there. And actually, and we'll touch a bit on one of the what-ifs at the end of this, but I think it's worth leading into now is it actually causes friction within the British forces as well. Because you've got this, you've got these incredibly well-trained decrypt troops who know what they're doing, led by officers who know what they're doing, now arriving on the scene in the US, and they're having to serve under local officers or local commanders who they just don't think are any good and who are more obsessed with how they look than how they fight. So Wellington at this point is writing multiple letters of complaint about the governor of Canada because his old officers are writing back to him and saying, we got there, we were ready to fight. We were told we weren't allowed to fight because we haven't got the right uniform hats. You know, and until we've sorted out our drill and sorted out our uniform hats, they won't let us go in and join the line of battle. And it's like, yeah, well, we worked out in the peninsula that those stocks, the heavy things you wear around your neck, we're not going to wear. So you get this genuine friction in the British forces between the people who have been fighting in Europe for 5-6 years and the ones in Canada who want to run things differently.
And then you get this. So this is, you know, if you look at British strategy in 1814, it is very much, you know, infuse the fight with these, with now you're bringing the rest of your force to bear. You have dual pressure. One, really going to lay it on New England. The Royal Navy begins a series of raids through 1814, devastating the New England countryside. An invasion force hits northern Maine, and Maine will remain occupied, a split force, or split state rather, for the duration, really till 1816. And really trying to peel, you know, pressure New England to peel them away. Most of what this does is actually pressures New England to finally kind of get involved, although the governor of Massachusetts still, you know, being an anti-federalist is like, yeah, I'm not providing any federal troops. I'll defend my coast. But so you've got this prong. This is also what causes troops to move against Washington and then Baltimore. And they begin offering the olive branch that with peace negotiations beginning in the summer of 1814. So as sort of the White House is burning, the many government capital buildings, and as the British are moving on Baltimore. Now, Baltimore would be a much more valuable, Washington is a backwater at this time. I'm sitting in Washington right now, and it's lovely. It's not we still don't have the mosquitoes under control, but the food's a lot better, as are the roads. Washington's a nothing. The port of Baltimore, however, that would be a major grab. The British are unable to do that. General Ross is killed in the fighting, you know, failed to reduce Fort McHenry, and so we get a national anthem out of it. Not a very good one. You can't sing it at the right range, which is weird because it's a drinking song.
It's better than ours. I'll give you guys that.
I don't know. Yours is more singable. There's another cool thing that happens towards the end of 1814, the Battle of Plattsburgh, which is another one of these naval, part land battles. The really cool part of the Battle of Plattsburgh is that the American ships essentially all kedge their anchors, which they borrow from the Royal Navy. Like the Nile, essentially. They borrow tactics from the Royal Navy, kedge their anchors, are able to maneuver their ships to bring greater firepower to bear on approaching British vessels and defeat them at the Battle of Plattsburgh.
And for those unfamiliar with kedging, probably the very, very rudimentary basic way to think of this is imagine using your anchor to handbrake turn your ship when you need to.
Yeah.
It's effectively what they do, and that was that terrible movie Battleship that has a scene where they literally do this with a giant US battleship. But it does kind of work when you're working in the wooden walls era, and the Royal Navy are masters of it. And as you say, I mean, I think it's only fair as well that Lieutenant General Provost is in charge of that battle. It's one of the reasons it goes so badly, and he's actually pushed for his removal as a result of that, because he's a very good politician. He's a terrible commander, and this very much plays into the Americans' hands, is because those peninsular officers are not there, the peninsular commanders are not the ones in charge, they kind of get away with it for a bit long enough to fight back and get those logistics change in place that you were talking about at the beginning. I think it's only fair as well that I give you the final battle to bring up, which is of course the Battle of New Orleans.
Takes place on my birthday. It's an auspicious day. It is most famous for the battle that had happened after the peace treaty had been signed. You know, so much of this war really deals with the length of time it takes to communicate across the Atlantic. So with instantaneous communication, this battle wouldn't have happened. But it is a very bloody nose to the British. Poor General Pakenham. It goes, you know, don't attack across broken ground, don't attack across a swamp. Come on, man, what are you doing? But there is this idea, you know, famous, you know, it's in every victorious military of, all right, just one push and, you know, they'll run. It sort of ends up being one of the bloodiest battles of really what was not a very bloody war. Lots of people died, mostly from disease. I think something like around 300 British dead. And if that's your, you know, your bloodiest sort of casualty producing action, yeah, this is not a really bloody war. Not to say that a lot of the guerrilla activity on the frontier doesn't get pretty nasty. You know, all these families fighting against each other, and especially in New York, you know, that New York frontier, sort of all the old wounds and memories of the revolution are coming out, all the old animosities. So when we talk about getting like a strong Canadian identity, you know, leaving behind that last vestige of the U.S. You know, these are people whose kids, people who are loyalists, who had fought against the revolution. Now their children are bearing arms against their, you know, their brothers' sons across the border. So it gets real, real messy. But as the British are defeated at New Orleans with the Americans under the command of General Jackson, who's going to use this as a springboard to the presidency, where he will just be a lunatic, as he always was. this really brings the war to a final end. And in typical American style, we will only remember the one battle, the very one-sided victory at the end of the war, and say, oh, yes, we did it. We absolutely defeated, we trounced those British. Forgetting that we flailed miserably the majority of the conflict.
And I think that's probably our good way to sum up the actual war. We'll talk a little bit about some of its interesting longer term consequences. But is that it really does end in a bit of a, everyone's a bit worn out. No one really wanted to fight it in the first place. Let's just call this a draw. Let's pretend it didn't happen. And that's effectively what happens. The American negotiators have actually been pushing for a peace for some time by this point. They'd already accepted they were never going to get territory. And it actually flipped, and it was the British who were going, well, actually, we might be able to get back some of the other side of those Great Lakes. And it's only really once Lord Liverpool as Prime Minister is forced by Lord Castlereagh and others, his foreign secretary, to go, no, look, can we just end this? Nobody wants this anymore.
Don't forget the insurance rates on shipping. Yeah. I mean, yeah. 300-400% from Lloyd's to insure any British flagged vessel.
And it's worth pointing out was just that, like,
insane.
This is an absolute, and we think of like global trade and global banking and everything now. I mean, this entire war from an American perspective is funded mostly by a British bank. Because the Americans have already got rid of their national bank by this point, because it's back to your Federalists' war, isn't it? Anyone who's seen Hamilton knows how this is all playing out. But is that Barings Bank, which is one of the biggest bank powers in the UK, right up until the 1980s and 90s, really, until its sudden collapse, it effectively guarantees all the American bonds during the war. So the Americans are fighting the British whilst a British bank is guaranteeing the Americans as good value for their loans on the aftermath of the war. And this is the same bank, of course, that funded the Louisiana Purchase. So it's so bizarre to think of like that interconnectedness. Great. But also I think it's why this war ends, and it does in a way where everyone goes, this is just not economically in any of our interests to do this. And actually, weirdly, I think both countries come out of it with a stronger friendship as a result.
Much more. It's almost like it was the, you know, a pot coming to boil and you needed to lift the lid to let some steam out. I mean, it's a horrible way to describe a conflict, one that essentially destroys so many Native nations' ability to live east or west of the Allegheny Mountain line. But as I said at the beginning, you know, it's a war where if you can count American victory, you know, U.S. victories on one hand, tactical victories, and then you come out of it and you look at sort of what does the U.S. go to war to do? You know, stop impressment. Well, they already had that by even before the war began. But we won't call it. We won't go for that. The British abandoning their forts along the Northwest, as they had promised to do under the Treaty of Paris 1783. All right, they got that. The British abandoning their native allies. Oh, yep, got that. And basically British recognizing America with greater trade rights. The U.S. comes out of this achieving every single strategic objective, with the exception of seizing Canada, which we will attempt to do in the USS Alabama, or the CSS Alabama claims in the 1860s and or the 1870s and 80s, when the United States sues Great Britain for construction of that famed Confederate commerce raider. And we're like, hey, you can give us $18 million or Canada. And the UK's like, yeah, no. You know, U.S. comes out looking pretty good. What it does leave, however, one of the fun, weird history things it leaves open is, what is the boundary line? Which is going to be for the rest of our history, we're good buddies with our good friends, the Brits, with a few exceptions. And mostly in the 1840s, things get a little weird surrounding boundary lines, where we almost go to war for trees in northern Maine and for like Oregon and Washington. Also trees.
The other fun one on that is obviously one of the immediate consequences of this is the Rush-Bigot Treaty of 1817, which is one of my favorite treaties ever, because of course I have favorite treaties. But this is the one that demilitarizes the Great Lakes, which is one of those things where both parties agree it's a really good idea and then spend the next 150 years absolutely regretting signing that treaty with each other, because now how the hell do you police this giant territory without arming stuff on it? But because locked into that same treaty is a whole bunch of stuff that cements the explicit borders of Canada and the US, or what will become Canada, is that nobody wants to deal with this treaty or unpick it, because as you say, there's all these minor disputes going on as well. I mean, one of my favorite stories ever is a fantastic museum. If you've never been to Buffalo Naval Park, which is on the Great Lakes, amazing naval museum, I was over there a few years back, and I was having a beer with the curator, and I said, "What's your favorite like weird story about this?" Because I always find it's the best thing to ask in a museum. And he said, "Well, in 1977, we almost accidentally invalidated the 1817 Treaty of Rush-Bagot without anyone thinking about it, because they've got a decommissioned missile cruiser there. They've got the USS Little Rock, and apparently, what happened was." That was en route. It was being tugged. It was being towed up there. Whilst it was being towed up, someone at the Home Office, the Foreign Office in the UK, was going through and saw this in the news and went, "Hang on, that's going to invalidate the treaty between the US and Britain over armed ships in the Great Lakes, because it was still technically a reserve ship at the time," and there had to be a frantic back and forth between the US sort of State Department and the British Foreign Office, culminating in a thing in Parliament in the UK, establishing that we all agreed that the USS Little Rock wasn't a military vessel. And Canada has to do the same thing with the US again. They both have to do it when both want to put Coast Guard cutters on the Great Lakes that are armed. So they then have to renegotiate those treaties again. So
that's tremendous.
These things last, you know, we almost accidentally broke the borders with Canada because of a museum ship.
Well, we still have, you know, you have the Aroostook War that almost breaks out, where Maine, the state of Maine, only a state by 20 years at that point, in the 1840s goes, "All right, we're declaring war on Canada." And the United States, General Winfield Scott, who comes up through the War of 1812, now the general of the army, is going, "Jesus Christ, people, like, what? No, you can't. He has to go up there, calm down." You know, Maine calls up 10,000 militia. We're like, we're marching on New Brunswick. Calms the whole thing down. But the whole thing comes out of that border dispute. No one knows where the actual border is in that area between Maine, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia. They eventually take it to a court of arbitration to the King of Belgium because, you know, he's the guy, right? They put in a whole bunch of maps in front of him and he goes, "You know, I have no clue. I still don't understand it." They finally come to an agreement. It's still not decided. There's still an island off the coast that is debated whether is this United States territory or is this Canadian territory? Still not entirely sure. So all these little, I think they were in such a hurry to sort of wrap things up that we get this stuff that sort of drifts down in time to us. We get, which of course, you mentioned the slave trade earlier. Part of the Treaty of Ghent is a British... The red line, you know, the notorious red line of Syria, this one actually gets observed, was the United States must recognize the international enforcement of a ban on slavery. Not that that does a damn to the United States, which is going to hang on to this peculiar institution, as it's called, referred to, and it becomes our own internal divide, which will drive the country apart and into eventual war. So it's just all this blowback over time, all this sort of trickle down from this conflict that we still, you know, for Americans, Canadians, they look at this as sort of their great patriotic war, to borrow a phrase. for us, it's really a footnote when in reality, it has so much more bearing on who we are as a people now.
And I think I'd probably like us to finish before we wrap up, I think, with one of my favorite what ifs. Which is that, of course, this war is going on after the end of the Peninsular War. And there is a very key British general standing there who could conceivably go over there and deal with this whole situation. And that is the Duke of Wellington. And the Duke of Wellington is actually offered command. He is offered command in America to go over there and effectively sort it out. And he turns it down. He turns it down basically because he's offered it because... Provost is causing so much issues with his officers, but he turns it down and instead decides to be the British representative to the Congress of Vienna. So to the negotiations to end the Napoleonic War and all of this kind of stuff. But that is one of those great what-ifs of history, because I don't think the US war would have ended any different. What Wellington would have done on arrival is, and what he wanted to do was effectively, this is all very silly. No one is going to win this. Let's just negotiate an end to it. And that's what he would have done.
And he enters a line of great highly successful British commanders who don't want to throw their reputations away on a war, on a silly war in America. Geoffrey Amherst, you know, hero of the Seven Years' War for the British, who, you know, gives New France, essentially Canada, to Great Britain. You know, in 1775, they're like, yo, Geoffrey Amherst, Henri Bouquet, you guys want to go back? And they're like, heck no, absolutely not. Which is how you sort of get this, you know, revolving door of really amateur sort of British tactical leaders, because all their big names are like, God, no, we're not going back there. Are you kidding me? And now we have to fight them? Gee, I mean, there's a great line, 1754 to 55, and a British regular setting foot in North America, looking around and saying, you know, I think of him as looking at sort of the Pennsylvania backcountry, sort of the road to Fort Pitt or Fort Duquesne, and saying, I cannot conceive how people would make war in this country. And that is sort of this encapsulating moment that I think so many British commanders, and I think Wellington is, first and foremost, he understands the duality of war. It's not just a battlefield thing. It's not just tactical wins and losses. It's an entire strategic, what does a win look like for Great Britain in this, you know, a situation? That's a question that I wish many American military leaders in the past 30 years would have asked. What does a win look like, and how do we get there? But yeah, I think he, even if he accepts command, I don't think that the outcome is vastly different. Because as you point out, everyone's tired of war and ready to wrap this up.
I think what's interesting with that is you end up with a situation where, if anything, that war ends faster. Not because he's doing anything magical, but as exactly as you say, it's because it's negotiated peace. But the real impact would just simply be one, and back to our thing of we started this with, which is the speed of communication. If Wellington is in the US overseeing things there, he's not in Europe when Napoleon returns. So you could weirdly have a thing where this war could maybe never have ended any differently. But if personnel had moved in different ways towards the end of it, it could have lost Britain a war in Europe accidentally, because if Wellington isn't there to work with Blücher at Waterloo, then there's an open question there as to what happens beyond that. And I just find that fascinating as a hinge point, and I think that's a lovely one to finish on. You know, if you're listening to this, get your opinions onto our discussion boards and go, actually ask yourself that, like, what would it change? Would it change anything? Would it change nothing? Because, yeah, I think we're probably both in agreement, aren't we? It would have changed absolutely nothing in the US. It just might have changed things elsewhere.
Which could have then changed things here. Who knows? The ripple effects are fantastic. The real question is, where would Richard Sharp end up? Would Richard Sharp end up with the Battalion of the 95th that shows up in North America? And that's a real fun what if.
Well, thank you very much for joining me on this. I think both of us have agreed that our respective side won the war, which I think is what you always find in any given conflict of this nature. Hopefully, listeners, you've got a bit of an understanding now about this forgotten conflict and why it's a hell of a lot more interesting than people think. Staffer, where can people find you if they want to read more of your stuff or just follow your nonsense as much as my nonsense?
Oh boy. Well, you can find me at angrystaffofficer.com, the blog site there, as well as under the same name on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Facebook, if you wish to see a cavalcade of nonsense, if you will.
Good nonsense, though. A nonsense I thoroughly enjoy. So thanks again for listening, everyone, and we will see you next episode. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.